It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. As a young writer, Muniru Ravanipur had hoped her work would keep her alive. But more often than not, it had been the source of conflict with the Islamic Republic of Iran, where she grew up. Ravanipur's fiction was seen as a threat by the government. She waited nearly 7 years to get permission to be published, 10 years for her first novel. Now a writer living in the United States, Ravanipur has authored a dozen novels and children's books and just published a new novel, Afsana. She is in Pittsburgh for a joint residency at the City of Asylum and the Ellis School, and she joins me now here in Studio A. Muniru Ravanipur, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Welcome to you. Nice to meet all of you, and hello to your audience and all readers that probably I have in this country and all around the world.
If you have a comment or question about Ms. Ravanipur's work or the state of things in her country of Iran, her native country of Iran, you can join the conversation by calling 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Our email address is esspgh@wesa.fm, and you can reach us on Twitter at esspgh and follow the conversation at #EPLive. Muniru Ravanipur, I describe the difficulty that you had in getting your work published when you were living in Iran as a young writer there. Describe the impact that censorship had on your life.
I didn't write before revolution. I started my writing after revolution. And
so this was after the fall of the Shah in 1979.
Yeah. And I wrote a short collection story that immediately they burned and banned this short collection. And after that, I thought that, it is better to write for myself without any hope, without any dream that maybe one day one of my story will publish. So I started to write for myself. But as you mentioned, I waited for... one of my novels, The Gypsy by the Fire, took 10 years to be published. And my first story collection, Kanizu, took 7 or 8. But that was not the only story that they banned or banned my short story collection.
Basically, they just didn't want people to see what you were writing. Did they ever say why, what it was about what you were writing that was in some way posing a danger to the Islamic Republic?
I am writing about life, about our society. I wrote about our society, about the women and how they struggle with their life, with their difficulties. And also, one of my books that has been banned for more than 30 years, it is about a dancer, and it is about someone who fell in love. It's about love.
A gypsy dancer and a man from Tehran who falls in love with her and follows her, correct?
No, it is my novel. Stones is about a dancer, and there is some sign of a Baha'i's symbol in this book. And when I came here, I thought that maybe one of the reasons that they banned this short story was that. But it is about dancer, about a woman who drinks, dance, has a lover, and
all the things that would typically be banned in current Iranian society.
Yeah,
let me ask you this. What was it like for women in Iran? And you really saw a real sea change, because in 79 you were not quite 30 yet. And the Shah of Iran was overthrown, and in comes the Ayatollah to take over. And so how did things change during that time?
Okay, we had to kind of change. First of all, we had our personal life. Nobody bother us or tell us do this and wear that or drink this one. Don't do that one. Mm-hmm. We have freedom in our personal life, but
this
political
was
life.
This was under the Shah.
Yeah, But political life, actually, no. Even those during the Shah, we don't have any political freedom.
Dissent was not tolerated.
No, absolutely. And, you know, there was a unknown fear on the air. I was a student. Nobody arrest you. Nobody tell you anything. But you always feel that you always feel that there is kind of anxiety. Maybe someone come and suddenly arrest you. It was the imagination of fear. It was is it hallucination? It's a kind of phobia or something. You know, the environment was not healthy. The situation was not healthy, although they didn't tell us about our life, our personal life.
So it wasn't as overt under the Shah, but there was still the fear, fear of making a misstep.
As a student of Pahlavi University, I felt it. All students felt it, really. And, okay, there were a lot of strike. And they arrest the student, but after 2 or 3 days, they release them. But this kind of fear that was not real, but it was, you know.
It sounded like it was something that permeated society and your life. So then when the Islamic Republic takes form, takes control, what is it like for women in Iran? You know, here you are.
Nobody knew that what would happen. The street was full of women who wanted Islamic Republic, not Islamic Republic, who wanted change. But actually at the first, we as a student were on the street, and the people, ordinary people, was standing on the pavement. And we tried to push them on the street, but they didn't know what is going on. And nobody knew who is Ayatollah Khomeini, really, believe me.
Nobody knew?
Nobody knew, really. And many students explained them that who is he. And all regular, ordinary people wanted, you know, they shook their hand and, you know, sometimes say bad word to us. That you are a spy, you are going to destroy the country, and this regular, ordinary people, but the old one, the grandpa, the grandma, they were always told us that you don't know this people, this group of people. We had a lot of experience, and if they get power, you will see what will happen.
So older people
happen.
Were warning you about what would take shape
in
Iran if the Ayatollah came to power. We're talking with Maniro Ravanipur, the exiled Iranian writer who is in Pittsburgh for a couple of days this weekend. And she will take your questions at 412-246-2002. And we have Dan in Friendship on the line. Dan, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh. You're on with Maniro Ravanipur.
Hi, Paul. Thank you. And I just wanted to extend a warm Pittsburgh welcome to the author. I had a question. I'm an international affairs student at the University of Pittsburgh. And we talk a lot about Iran, obviously. I just wanted to know the author's opinion. I read a good piece in the National Geographic a few months back about how women of Iran are actually very fashionable, and the West doesn't see that. The West only sees, you know, these head-to-toe coverings and all black and modesty. You know, it's rather drab. But in the privacy of their own home, they're actually very, you know, very fashionable, have bright colors and everything. I just wanted the author to address that and see what her opinion was on that.
Interesting question, Dan.
Thank you. Yeah, this is a good question. Actually, we have all in Iran have two kind of life, outdoor and indoor. Outside of our house, we have to follow the rules. And
you have to cover up.
Yeah, cover up and be obedient.
And this is what Americans know about what happens in Iran.
Inside,
what Dan is saying is there's another side to Iranian women. That's, so behind closed doors, what is it like?
It's completely another life.
Really?
Yeah, completely another life. We don't have any hijab. We drink whatever we want. We dance. We sing. A real life that you have in United States or all people has in their country, their Western country. No, there is no hijab, no rule, no Islamic Sharia rule, law, no nothing.
Well, under the new Iranian president, Hassan Rouhani, we are hearing that things are easing up for people and for women in Iran. Are based on what you know, are things changing there now?
When I wanted to come here, I put this question on Facebook and asked my readers that are all around the world, especially in Iran, and I got different kind of answer. A group of them.
When you came to Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
So just recently.
I told them maybe someone asked me this question, and I am not in my country. Can you tell me what is your opinion? And some of them, they deny any change, but some of them say there is a change, and we have to wait, and there is a little and slow step, but not that kind of change that we want. Actually,
so things are changing, but not at the rate at which you'd like to see it.
I think the most important thing is this: President Rouhani doesn't put another problem on our shoulder himself. And personally, he's not a problem. He himself doesn't do anything. Like the ex-president, that he was always trying to make problem with the world and with us, with everybody.
He's not as bad as Ahmadinejad.
No, he's not.
So who's making the trouble then now? It's...
When we define freedom... The definition of freedom is different from me to President Rouhani. You know, they are both in the same frame, but their place is different. They believe God, they believe Sharia law and everything, but they are different. Their perspective is a little bit different. President Rouhani is not as bad as Ahmadinejad. He was insane, I think. He was mentally retarded. He was not a human being because he not only wanted to make problem for us, but he denied Holocaust. He denied everything.
Right. And we saw this. We saw this at the UN and whatnot. Again, I want to remind our listeners that we are talking with exiled Iranian writer Maniro Ravanapour. If you have a comment or question for her, 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Some of the events that shaped your life and your writing, informed your writing, are things that I wanted to ask about. And one of the things I wanted to bring up, as painful as it might be for you, was the day that soldiers from the Islamic Republic barged into your home in Iran and arrested and killed your 19-year-old brother. Was any reason given for this action?
There is no reason there. When they arrest you, kill you, or torturing you, they never say any reason. The reason was because they had power. That's all, and they want to establish to their power to be stable. So, yeah, they killed him. And
I read you said one something that you wrote or were quoted as saying that they would do this kind of thing. There would be random arrests and killings to prevent groups from dissenters from organizing.
Absolutely, yeah. They attack on the street and get and collect many people randomly, and then release. They took 100 and released 99, and just keep one of them and killed him.
Hmm.
That's all.
And for no reason.
For no reason.
So to this day, your brother murdered at 19. You still don't know. You still haven't been given a reason by from anyone
for his
killing.
Look, they have their own reason. They say very dirty things about those who arrested and killed them. They say they were a spy, or they were against Islamic Republic, or they had many criminal things. But when revolution started, my brother was 16. What was happened with 16 boys? After revolution, during 3 days, what did they do to my brother that he become a criminal, that they put him on the wall and killed him? He was a straight A student. He worked out. He was wrestling. He liked to wrestle.
So he was an athlete. He was a good student. He was a good young man.
Yeah. And then what was happened? What was the culture? How they this intruder came to our country and just killed many, many young people full of energy, full of knowledge, full of love. And then they say that you have to forget about it. No. How can I forget those days, those nights?
You spent time in prison, and you said that you were worried that you could be killed without anyone knowing what happened to you.
Yeah.
How did experiencing that kind of fear impact your life and your writing?
A lot, really. When I was that night, I was surrounded by darkness and coldness, and it was horrendous, really. And I thought, oh, my God, they will kill me and nobody knows. But I told myself, if I get rid of this situation, if they release me, I would get writing seriously. And you know why? When I came here, for 2 days, I didn't write, and I felt short of breath. And I say, what is wrong? And then I remember that night, after a long time, after many years. And I had enough time to think about my memory. And I could remember them. And suddenly I understood that I write for being alive. I write because I don't want anybody come and kill me. And because of this, when I don't write, I feel a lot of anxiety. I couldn't breathe.
So writing is really
a
release for you.
Yeah, it is a release.
We're talking with the exiled Iranian writer Maniro Ravanapour, who is in Pittsburgh for a joint residency at the City of Asylum and the Ellis School. If you would like to join the conversation, 412-246-2002. We have Tom in Pittsburgh on the line. Tom, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh. You're on with Maniro Ravanapour.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was just hoping that our guest could comment on this, and that is, there is a history of U.S. intervention in Iran that is hidden from most of us. And that is, I think about Mohammad Mossadegh, the George Washington of democratic reform in Iran, being overthrown by the United States at the behest of the British and the French back in the 1950s. And while that doesn't make the United States responsible for all the bad things that have happened in Iran, it certainly makes us partly responsible for some of the tyranny in Iranian history. And I'd like your comment.
Well, stay with us, Tom. I want to really try to distill the question for Maniro. You're saying that the United States, going back to the Shah, that the United States was oppressing those that the idealists in Iran.
No, actually, it's before the Shah that we know. It's before the Shah that was put in power, that was overthrown by the Ayatollah and the forces of the Ayatollah. The person who preceded him was the first democratically elected prime minister of Iran. There was a democratic parliament, and that individual, he was an Oxford-educated man, Mohammad Mossadegh, was overthrown by a CIA operation led by a guy named Kermit Roosevelt, and it was at the behest of the British and the French that it happened. It happened under President Eisenhower. President Eisenhower had signed off on it.
So your question for Maniro is what then?
Well, I just I know that history is well known in Iran, but it's absolutely forgotten in the United States. And I was wondering if she'd comment on that.
Okay.
I was born a year after Mossadegh, and my father was the member of International Front. My cousin was the member of Tudeh party, and my uncle was a lawyer nationalist. And after Co, they got together and talking about the political issue, and recite many poems, political poems and love poems. And this gathering affected on my writing a lot. And I couldn't overlook the social political issue in my writing, not really a fairy tale that I hear from fishermen and those women who were in our village. But about Mossadegh, this year I say one sentence. Look, I want to stop blaming others for our history.
You want to stop blaming others for Iran's history?
Yeah, because you know,
including the United States?
Yeah, everybody.
Which propped
the Shah? We have to think about ourselves. That is enough. We blame everybody a lot, other countries a lot. Now this is the turn that we think about ourselves, our people, our leaders. What did Mossadegh do during those times, you know? Was he enough flexible in his relationship?
There's certainly a lot of history there to question. I before we run out of time, I wanted to make sure that we got another caller who wants to get in, and I believe it's Sarash. I hope I'm saying that name correct, in Pittsburgh. Welcome to the show.
Hello, both of you. Thank you for having me. Just a real quick question. I'm actually a Zoroastrian. And Zoroastrians originated in ancient Persia, parts of Iran right now. I was wondering, as an author, and I've never been to Iran, how writing on Zoroastrianism by maybe not this author, but in general, is that taken by the government, and whether it is encouraged, or whether you authors have the same problem, other authors have the same issues that you're facing when they wrote on Zoroastrianism.
Zoroastrianism. Are you Zoroaster, you say?
I am a Zoroastrian.
Oh, are you from India? Or
yes.
I think all independent writers in Iran faced the same problem that I faced. And this is not special for me or two or three other writers that came here or they went to go to Europe. And we struggle with this problem all our life. You know, being a writer in Iran is not easy. We spent a lot of energy for fighting, for going forward, and for struggling with simple things that everybody in all other, any writer in Western country has. And this is really, you know, sad, because make us mad and make us tired sometimes. Yeah.
Speaking of sad...
Yep.
Do you miss Iran?
I miss my country. I miss my friend. But actually,
I read somewhere where you said what you really miss is the sea.
Yeah, because I was growing up in a sea, in a village beside the sea, and I was growing up with mermaid and old fairy tale, many myth, and. I miss those location, those area. But when I remember that what is going on, when I remember that if I go there, I have to the first place that I will see is airport. And the women with a black chador, that is not in, that is not familiar for me yet after too many years. Because believe me, we didn't have any chador, black chador in our village. We had colorful clothes. And the mosque was not for punishing people. It was for laughing. It was for being friends with each other. And only 2 times per year, they opened the mosque and we had a ceremony. We had a theater. We had our life. And I don't know which kind of mosque they introduced to us, and you know, they changed all ceremony gradually. All the men were naked when there was Ashura. That, you know, from right. this part, they were naked. And then, you know, they ordered that nobody, you have to wear your clothes. And, you know, in the south of Iran, it is very hot. The weather is very hot. How can I? They wear these clothes. That's terrible, yeah.
We've been talking with exiled Iranian writer Maniro Ravanapour. She's been our guest, and she is in Pittsburgh for a joint residency at the City of Asylum and the Ellis School. Maniro Ravanapour, it's been a pleasure and an honor. Thank you so much for joining us on Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you, and I enjoy your talking, the question, and thank you for me.
You're welcome. Thank you. Coming up, what can Pittsburgh, Providence, Copenhagen, and similar places learn from each other? It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.